Hi, Dave Gremmer here. This is For the Record, program number 878. Update on Pan-Turkism, Islamism, and the Earth Island Boogie. This is being recorded on December 4th of the year 2015. This program is going to be, it is a point of continuum or continuation, and also at the same time something of a point of departure for future discussions. We have spoken about the Earth Island, we have spoken about Pan-Turkism, we have spoken about indications that the Pan-Turkist movement and the Islamist movement growing out of the Muslim Brotherhood have been growing together for quite some time. That confluence, that growing together of the Pan-Turkist movement and the Islamist movement, primarily growing based around the Muslim Brotherhood with strong input from the Wahhabi, that connection is growing much more concrete. It appears to be one of the central things that is figuring in the turmoil, not only in Syria and Iraq and the Middle East, but also in Ukraine and the Crimea in particular, and also in China as well. This program is going to consist largely of a review of information from AFA Program 14 about the Pan-Turkist movement, its history, its association with the Third Reich, and the genesis of the National Action Party, Alparslan Turkish, the Grey Wolves, etc. This particular program will be one of those broadcasts that relies very heavily on the written description for the program, and this program also will be heavily overlapped with programs to come. We're going to be talking about the genesis of ISIS, which appears to be an outgrowth once again of the use of weaponized religion, in this case weaponized Islam, by elements of the West looking to not only destabilize to the point of breaking up Russia, but also doing something very similar with China. Once again, the Earth Island, that giant stretch of land that goes from the Straits of Gibraltar in Europe all the way across Europe, all the way across the Middle East, embraces Russia, China, India, and has most of the world's landmass, most of the world's population, and most of the world's natural resources as well, including and especially fossil fuels. The Pan-Turkist movement appears to be once again not only growing ever closer to the Islamist movement, it heavily overlaps it at this point, but weaponized Islam, both the Muslim Brotherhood and the heavily overlapped Pan-Turkist movement also appear to be, in fact, there's very good evidence that it is growing together with the Western effort, the covert operation in Ukraine that restored the OUNB fascists, a World War II-era Ukrainian fascist, to power in Ukraine. We've spoken about that in some 30 previous programs. We are going to highlight the Islamist and the Pan-Turkist connection to the Ukrainian operation in this program, and we're going to do that in future broadcasts as well. Now, I want to emphasize that this will be a program in which the written description is fundamental simply due to the limitations of time. I have not got time to read all of the material that I need to read. So I'm going to be citing the articles and reading short excerpts of the articles, and the links and more text are available in the description for the record 878, which will be available presently, later this evening being December 4th of the year 2015. Now, looking at the Earth Island, and in particular Russia and China, note several things. Obviously, Russia is now militarily engaged in the Middle East. There is a proxy war between Shia Muslims, primarily Iran, Syria, and elements in Lebanon, and Sunni Muslims backed by Saudi Arabia, backed by Turkey, backed by the West, and grouped around the Muslim Brotherhood with strong support from the Wahhabi Saudis as well. The evidence suggests very strongly that the corporatist economics of the Muslim Brotherhood at one level and the use of the Muslim Brotherhood and the overlapped pan-Turkists as proxy warriors basically is the philosophy that is driving what is taking place in the Middle East. Now, obviously, there have been several things that have taken place recently. First of all, a Russian Su-24 tactical combat aircraft was shot down by Turkey. That appears to have been the propaganda, frankly, being generated by Turkey and echoed in the West. That appears to have been a predetermined ambush by the Turks. That plane, it is not at all clear that it really did intrude on Turkish airspace. It was there for all of 17 seconds, if in fact it did. And you don't shoot a plane like that down. You dispatch an aircraft to do what is known as an intercept. You contact it. The transgressing or trespassing aircraft is contacted, and the intercepting aircraft flies on a parallel course. Nothing like that took place. However, when the plane was shot down, it was conducting operations against some of the rebels in Syria who are of Turkic extraction and receiving support from Turkey. And I would note that the pilot of the plane was shot down, was executed, however, by some of these Turkic rebels being supported at one level by Turkey and also apparently by elements of Western intel, including elements of CIA. The International Business Times has an article by John Lee Varghese from November 27th of the year 2015. Syria, photos of Alparslan Shelik, A-L-P-A-R-S-L-A-N as in Nancy, C-E-L-I-K, rebel leader who shot Russian pilot, go viral. The photos of Alparslan Shelik, a Syrian rebel leader from Turkey, are being widely shared on social media after he appeared in a video boasting of how he and his men shot the Russian pilot while he parachuted out from his plane on November 24th. And the article goes on to say that not only is Alparslan Shelik a member of the Grey Wolves, the youth wing and combat cadre, so to speak, of the National Action Party, but that his father is a National Action Party official in Turkey proper. I would also note an article by Eric Schmidt of the New York Times of June 21st of 2012. CIA is said to aid in steering arms to Syrian opposition. A small number of CIA officers are operating secretly in southern Turkey, helping allies decide which Syrian opposition fighters across the border will receive arms to fight the Syrian government, according to American officials and Arab intelligence officers. Skipping down. The weapons are being funneled mostly across the Turkish border by way of a shadowy network of intermediaries, including Syria's Muslim Brotherhood, and paid for by Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. So again, we have Turkish, ethnic Turks being supported by Turkey, embodying Grey Wolves and people descended politically from the National Action Party, fighting as part of the anti-Assad coalition in Syria with support not only from Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, but elements of CIA as well. In the past, we have also noted, for example, from this Business Insider article by Barbara Tash, featured in Yahoo News of July 21st of 2015, anti-China sentiment is suddenly sweeping over Turkey, that basically the Turkophone Uyghurs, who are Muslims, who also have strong links to Al-Qaeda, as we have looked at in a number of programs, including most recently, for the record, 863. Basically, the Grey Wolves and the National Action Party and the Pan-Turkists are very anti-Chinese at the moment because the Muslim and Turkophone Uyghurs, again affiliated with Al-Qaeda, are being used in Xinjiang province in China, a not surprisingly fossil fuel-rich area of China, and the Uyghurs are basically seeking autonomy. An article from the Sydney Morning Herald of August 30th of 2015 by Lindsay Murdoch, M-U-R-D-O-C-H, Bangkok bombing, who are the Turkish terrorist group the Grey Wolves. And what this talks about is a bombing in Bangkok that appears to have been perpetrated by the Pan-Turkist Grey Wolves. It notes that the Grey Wolves, the best known of the Grey Wolves, is Mehmet Ali Aja, who shot Pope John Paul II and who featured prominently in our series about the shooting of the Pope. And apparently the Bangkok bombing was in retaliation for the extradition of a number of Uyghurs to China by Thailand, and the Grey Wolves figure prominently in that. I would note that this article notes about the Grey Wolves. The group's ideology centers on the glory days of Turkish history, seeking to unite Muslim Turkic peoples from the Balkans to Central Asia in a pan-Turkish extension of the Turkish nation-state. The group extended operations in the early 1990s into post-Soviet states with Turkic and Muslim populations, including the Nagorno-Karabakh War in Azerbaijan and the Chechen conflicts as well. Recently, the power lines running from Ukraine into Crimea were sabotaged. An article by a Reuters story carried in Yahoo News of November 27th of 2015 by Pavel Polityuk, P-O-L-I-T-Y-U-K. Ukraine leaves sabotaged power lines to Russia annexed Crimea in the mud. Notes that a Ukrainian lawmaker close to Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said basically that the Crimean blackout had been orchestrated with the tacit consent of Kiev. Interestingly, as indicated both in a New York Times article from November 23rd of 2015 by Ivan Netchuparenko and Neil McFarquhar called "As Sabotage Blacks Out Crimea, Tatars Prevent Repairs," that sabotage appears to have been a collaborative effort by Crimean Tatars and Pravi Sector, the OUNB heirs, who have not only worked as anti-quote terrorist unquote militia for the Ukrainian government, they are part of the Ukrainian government and very closely connected to the Ukrainian intelligence service. GermanForeignPolicy.com that feeds along the lower right-hand side of the front page of this of the SpitfireList.com website of November 26th of 2015 has the siege of Crimea and notes not only have Pravi Sektor and the Crimean Tatars apparently collaborated to sabotage the pylons have supported the electricity going into Crimea. 80% of Crimea's power comes from Ukraine. But they had previously collaborated in blocking road traffic into Crimea and in interfering with the Crimean water supply. Previously, we have noted that Chechen Islamists with very strong ties to ISIS and to the Turkish support for ISIS have shown up in Ukraine fighting against the Russian-backed separatists and again under the administrative command of Pravi Sektor. And again, those Islamists have come from the Syrian/ISIS milieu. In addition, I want to note, as cited here, in Middle East Online of March 13th of 2014, Turkey moves to protect Crimea's Tatar minority. Skipping down. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has pledged to support Crimea's Turkish-speaking Tatar minority, which Ankara fears could be sidelined in a March 16th vote on switching over to Kremlin rule. And a New York Times story from March 14th of 2014 by Noah Snyder, Crimean Tatars on guard against joining Russia, has noted that Tatar militants have fought alongside the opposition in Syria, and Hizb-ut-Tahrir, an Islamic group banned in several countries, including Russia, has 1,000 members in Crimea. So what we have basically is the Turkish government supporting the Turkic and Turkophone Tatars in Crimea. They in turn are working with private sector against the Russian-speaking minority there. Previously Chechen Muslims, who have also been backed by the Grey Wolves and the Pan-Turkists, have shown up in Ukraine under private sector command. And again, the Grey Wolves and the Pan-Turkists are very prominent in the combat in Syria as well. And the Grey Wolves and the Pan-Turkist movement are backing the separatist aspirations of the Uyghurs in China as well. So if we look at the Earth Island, we've got Islamist / Pan-Turkist / Grey Wolf / Muslim Brotherhood terrorism in Xinjiang. We've got something very similar now. We've got Grey Wolf / Pan-Turkist / Muslim Brotherhood / Islamist collaboration in Syria. And we've got both Chechen, ISIS-linked Muslims, and Crimean Tatars working with private sector in Crimea against the Russian-backed separatists. We've got basically a dovetailing of the Pan-Turkist and Islamist elements all around the Earth Island, again functioning as proxy warriors at one level, manifesting weaponized Islam, as we spoke about in our discussions with Peter Lavenda, and functioning as agents of corporatism and working as combatants against Russia and China. I realize this is a mouthful. We will be going back into this in future programs as we talk about the bloody and very tangled events in the Earth Island and the genesis of ISIS as well. And certainly elements of CIA as well as Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia are backing this whole thing. Now, for background on the Pan-Turkist movement, we're going to go back to January 1986, and we're going to listen to AFA number 14, or an excerpt thereof. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck. And pay particular attention to Alparslan Türkeş, the founder of the National Action Party and of the Grey Wolves.
The Turks, although in the 20th century their power was largely eclipsed, there remained among the Turkish people not only a strong longing on the parts of certain people for empire, but also because many, many ethnic Turks lie outside of modern Turkey, there was a strong nationalist movement among the so-called outside Turks, people of Turkish extraction who live outside the borders of modern Turkey. Now, this Pan-Turkist movement has been very, very strong in the 20th century, and because many of the Turk-ik speaking peoples lie inside the boundaries of the modern Soviet Union, Pan-Turkism took a largely anti-Soviet character in its attempt to unite all Turkic speaking peoples under into one national entity. The Pan-Turkist movement has sought the return of many of the Turkic speaking areas of the Soviet Union as part of a greater Turkey. And this Pan-Turkist movement is one of the things that we're going to be looking at, and its incorporation into the ABN. This will be cropping up later in future broadcasts, in particular in the background of the shooting of the Pope. We're not going to look at that specifically this evening, but we are going to look at the Pan-Turkist movement as part of German fascism and even before, and we're going to see how that became incorporated into the ABN.
Now, recalling again fascist Poland under Marshal Pilsudski and its aspirations to regain part of the Soviet Union, one of the things that Marshal Pilsudski set up was something called the Prometheus Organization, okay, the name for the Greek god who brought fire to man, supposedly, the Greek Titan, I should say. And the Prometheus Organization was basically, as the researcher, by the way, credit for all of the information on the Pan-Turkist movement here, including the Prometheus Organization, goes to a fabulous researcher in the East. And when these people were actually two researchers, and when they were explaining this to me, they characterized the Prometheus movement as sort of a pre-wackle-wackle, at least with regard to its European and Eurasian components. It basically was just that. It was sort of an anti-Soviet group which was composed largely of various nationalist groups inside the Soviet Union and sought to break up the Soviet Union and defeat the Soviet government in that way. It was not only anti-Soviet, but anti-communist and explicitly fascist in its outlook, although many of the people involved with it were nationalists, and the anti-communism and fascism were secondary, if there were of any importance at all to them. However, the organization itself, as we're going to see, began cooperating with the Third Reich, which made good use of pan-Turkist elements. Following information about the Prometheus Network, this pre-Wackel-Wackel based in Pilsudski's Poland, which involved pan-Turkist elements to a considerable extent, information on this comes from a book called Pan-Turkism in Turkey, subtitled A Study of Irredentism, was authored by Jacob Landau, L-A-N-D-A-U, published in London by C. Hurst and Company. I don't know the date offhand. And Landau writes of the Prometheus Network as follows. Speaking of the period just before World War II, during this period, several periodicals of pan-Turk character were published in Europe. Most were issued regularly, probably because of the expenses involved, but there were two exceptions. Turan Mekumasi, published in Budapest, and Prometheus, an anti-Soviet journal originating in Poland. And of Prometheus, skipping down, Landau writes, and talking here about something which we needn't concern ourselves with, which is pan-Turanic journals here and so forth, it was evident that it's not important to pay attention to that, but leading into discussion of the Prometheus Network, it was evident that the Turan Society and its publications constituted an expression of the isolation felt by the Hungarians in what appeared to them as a hostile environment, as well as a manifestation of their search for potential allies. To a great extent, this was also the feeling of those Polish circles which published the other long-term interwar periodical, Prometheus. This was the organ of the Promethean League, a semi-clandestine, anti-Soviet association established and sponsored by President Pilsudski, the Polish Ministry for Foreign Affairs, and the General Staff as an umbrella organization to provide financial assistance and political coordination for anti-communist governments in exile. All those who had suffered at the hands of the Soviets were considered as their natural allies against the Soviet peril. Among these, the outside Turks held a prominent position. The association's bulletin, Prometheus, Organe de Défense des Nationales des Peuples du Caucase et de l'Ukraine, was published monthly in Paris from November of 1926 to April of 1938. Note here that in addition to the outside Turks, Ukrainian nationalists were very prominent in Prometheus. Continuing. Turkestan was subsequently added to its masthead, and the publication was ultimately named Prometheus, Organe de Défense des Nationales des Peuples Opprimés of the USSR. Well-known pan-Turkists such as Rezul Zad, Mirza Bala, and others contributed articles about the strong sentiments for independence and for a pan-Turk union in Azerbaijan, the Caucasus, and Turkestan. Polish financial aid to pan-Turkist organizations may well have continued even during the Second World War. This subject, however, lies beyond the scope of our immediate concern. What does not lie outside of the scope of our immediate concern, though, is that the anti-Soviet aspirations of the pan-Turkists and other elements, the Ukrainians of the Promethean League, were to find expression in the Third Reich.
Now, this next section is from a book called Turkism and the Soviets, and the book is by Charles Warren Hostler, Colonel, U.S. Air Force, and it's published 1957 by George Allen and Unwin Limited of London.
It's also worth noting that some of the people who helped, this guy was an Air Force colonel who did a lot of research on this stuff, and there's an interesting note there.
And as we get into this, the segment we're reading itself, you'll notice a kind of a slightly interesting tone to some of the comments the man makes about these Turkish connections to the Third Reich. And one of the things, you may remember a name from the first article that we read, he talks about Hostler in his foreword, mentions, how does he put it? Okay, here, returning from Turkey in 1950, I was assigned to the U.S. Air Force's far-sighted graduate training program at Georgetown University. Okay. In this period, I had the good fortune to become associated with Dr. Stefan T. Pasani, who guided me in writing a shorter study, The Pan-Turanian Appeal, etc., etc. And he thanks Pasani again at the end. Now, Pasani, again, is a figure of the far right affiliated with Wackel, as we mentioned in the first article.
And a member of the WACCFL steering committee that we just looked at with Messrs. Kramer and Guyland.
And a bigwig at our own local Hoover Institution, as well as his affiliation with Georgetown. Georgetown, of course, we've talked about a great deal because of its involvement in a whole variety of right-wing politics. And it's basically, among other things, it's a journalist factory for the right wing. And we talked about Claire Sterling, Michael Ledeen, Arno de Borgrav, etc., etc. Claire Sterling, Michael Adine, again, particularly interesting because of the fact that, as Dave mentioned, the pan-Turkish movement comes in very strongly into the assassination attempt on the Pope. And here we have this other connection to Georgetown, to Pisani, and things like that. People writing about these same groups also, and also being affiliated with the World Anti-Communist League. So that's something we'll probably get into at a later point. Anyway, I'm going to read a little bit from Turkism and the Soviets by Charles Warren Hostler, USAF and Georgetown graduate. The pan-Turkist irredentists regarded as inevitable the defeat of the USSR and considered possible the creation of a confederation of all the Turkish peoples of Soviet Russia and Chinese Turkestan under the Turkish Republic's leadership. In general, Soviet sources are in accord with the Western ones on this question. And Miller, in his Ocherki Noveshi Histori Turci, begins the story of German-Turkish collaboration with a period preceding the outbreak of the German-Soviet War. Four days prior to the German attack on the Soviets on July 18, 1941, the Turkish-German Pact of Friendship and Non-Aggression was signed. In the interval from 1941 to 1942, the Turkish press openly assailed the Soviets. There were indications of increased Turkish preparation to take part in events and to arrange Caucasian and other Turkish areas independently or with German concurrence. In the autumn of 1942, the Turks concentrated troops at the Caucasian border, anticipating the fall of Stalingrad. The anti-Soviet campaign of the Turkish press had then reached its zenith. One may conclude that highly placed persons in the Turkish state had plans ready to exploit all the possibilities the German-Soviet war and a collapse of the USSR could furnish for the realization of pan-Turkish ideals. The outbreak of the war in June 1941 aroused great hopes among the Turco-Tatar leaders scattered in the West and in Turkey. Nearly all of these leaders approached the Germans and supplied them with various aid memoirs, documents, etc. The Germans also sought contacts and the exchange of opinions. Veli Kajum Khan, one of the chief followers of Mustafa Chokai, also Kokayo or Chokayov, a leader of the Turkestanis, we'll just call him Mustafa Chokai, a leader of the Turkestanis, was in touch with the Germans and had given them pertinent facts on Turkestan. He insisted that Turkestan should not become part of any future Russian Federation. Mehmet Emin Rezulzadeh, the head of the Azerbaijan Musavat Party, went to Bucharest after the occupation of Poland in 1939. He sent an exhaustive report to the Germans and subsequently went to Berlin. The Promethean leaders, who were living in Warsaw during the German occupation, also supplied the Germans with material.
Noting there a continuation of anti-Soviet policy from the Promethean organization originally under Polish sponsorship, a continuity of action to the Third Reich.
Ayas Ishaki and Syed Shamil, leaders of the Kazan Tatars and North Caucasians respectively, also went to Berlin. The Crimean Turks were represented in Berlin by Mustagib Fazil and Edige Kirimal, mentioned above in the letter from General, well, we don't care about that, and several Turkish politicians and unofficial representatives, including ex-General Erkilet, traveled there, several Turkish politicians and unofficial representatives, including ex-General Erkilet, traveled there or visited the front lines. Edige Kirimal and other Turco-Tatar leaders were permitted by the Germans to visit the occupied portions of the Turco-Tatar regions of the Soviet Union, namely Crimea and the Northern Caucasus. A most important political and military aspect of World War II pan-Turkist activity involved the national military units formed of Turks from the Soviet Union, who fought in the German armed forces against the Soviets. The idea of forming these units originated with two prominent Turks, Mustafa Chokai and Veli Kajum Khan. Mustafa Chokai died in December 1941, but German-educated Kajum Khan became commissioner for Turkestan, together with the other commissioners for Azerbaijan, Volga, Ural, Caucasus, and Crimea, who were appointed by the German Ostministerium, Ministry for Occupied Eastern Territories. The idea of using the Turks of the USSR in the fight against the Soviets must have been readily accepted by the German high command, whose approach to such problems were purely utilitarian. There was probably no serious Nazi political opposition to this idea, as the territories inhabited by the Turks of the USSR lay in general outside the limits of planned direct expansion of the Reich.
I would interrupt that this is wishful thinking on his part. In fact, one of the key people that we're going to look at, Theodor Oberland, now this is sort of an aside, who was actually imprisoned in a concentration camp for a short time, for proposing the use of these various Turkic nationalities as allies of the Third Reich. After a while, the German losses forced a reconsideration of that position. But initially, they were pure Aryans, and so they were actually scornful. Although they would use them, they would not grant them equal ally status. And so that's actually sort of not an accurate statement on his part here.
The Germans needed military security and combat replacements. The receptiveness of the Turkish prisoners of war to the proposal stemmed in part from their political and religious convictions. The Wehrmacht was aware of their propaganda influence on other Soviet troops of Turk background, and also their political potential of diminishing enemy resistance, achieving speedy pacification of occupied territory, and making allies out of these populations. The overwhelming majority of the Turk volunteers were recruited from among Soviet prisoners of war captured by the Germans. The 162nd Infantry Division, commanded by General Oskar von Niedermayer, a well-known German specialist in Middle Eastern affairs, was assigned the task of organizing them into combat battalions. This activity was implemented by Army Group South, which was largely in the central Ukraine area. A top-secret memoir by Rosenberg, that's Albert Rosenberg, concerning his discussion with Hitler on December 14, 1941, indicates by that date, partial Turkization of these units was completed, and the experience was judged successful. On December 30, 1941, the High Command of the Wehrmacht was directed to establish a Turkestan Legion, consisting of members of the following nationalities: Turkmens, Uzbeks, Kazakhs, Kyrgyzs, Karakalpaks, and Tajiks. B, Caucasian Mohammedan Legion, composed of Azerbaijanis, Dagestanis, Ingushes, Lezhins, and Chechens. C, a Georgian Legion, and D, an Armenian Legion.
By the way, Armenia is one of these territories which has sort of got bisected during the imperial period. Half of it's in Russia, half of it's in Turkey. Like Azerbaijan, another area in the Soviet Union, is half in Soviet and half in Iran.
A Volga Tatar Legion and a North Caucasian Legion were formed in 1942. These legions were training centers where national units were organized and indoctrinated. For each of them, a corresponding national committee existed. The commanding officers of these legions had the disciplinary authority of a commander of an independent battalion. They were subordinate to the commander of the 162nd Infantry Division. The legions received prisoners of war from collecting camps and were charged with training them into future combat battalions. Each legion headquarters had a permanent cadre of German military personnel and the necessary number of Turks selected by the legion commander. After completing of their training and political indoctrination, the combat battalions left the 167th Infantry Division for attachment to different active German divisions. During the subsequent war years, the Turks, the Germans grouped the Georgians, Armenians, etc. under this term as well, furnished the rank and file elements of 19 unattached battalions and 24 companies. Among other duties, these units were used for frontline action and for fighting partisans. As early as May 1942, Turk Battalion No. 450 fought valiantly against partisans near Jampol in the Ukraine and dispersed the enemy after suffering 28 casualties. There were only two German officers and two non-commissioned officers attached to this battalion. The post of General der Osttruppen was established in December 1942. It was occupied first by General Helmich and then by General Kestring. As a result of the activities of the Turkestan National Committee, the East Turkish Waffenverband, a Waffen-SS unit, was formed in 1944 of four regiments of two battalions each, one composed of Turks from Turkestan, another of Azerbaijanis, a third one of Volga-Ural Turks, and the fourth of Crimean Tatars. Now, one thing to notice here, just for future reference, because we're not going to need to deal with it too much tonight, but notice the fact, again, as so often happened to these groups, of these groups with whatever their particular gripe was to begin with, getting involved in coming into the Nazi sphere of influence, and then not only having that initial movement in that direction, but then going through official training and indoctrination. And believe me, folks, it seems to stick, and we're going to be talking about that in future broadcasts.
Okay, and again, note the continuity of policy from the various anti-Soviet groups who combined under the Promethean banner in Pilsudski's Poland. Then Prometheus gives assistance during the German occupation to the Nazis. The Pan-Turkists seize upon the Nazis as they're basically their vehicle for the partitioning of the Soviet Union and the adding of the Turkic speaking peoples to a greater Turkey. and note in particular the use of various Turkic minorities in German military units to fight against the USSR. Now again, the anti-Bolshevik nations, or the peoples involved with the anti-Bolshevik nations, became one of the key elements of the Galen spy organization both during World War II and afterward when it jumped to the U.S. Now recall the various Turkic minorities working for the Germans in their military units. Reading a short section now from a book called Galen, Spy of the Century, published in hardcover by Random House, copyright 1971, and authored by a man named E.H. Cookridge. Galen, by the way, was the head of Foreign Armies East. He was Hitler's chief intelligence officer for the Eastern Front, in charge of all intelligence activities in that theater. After the war, he jumped to the United States and then NATO and finally to West Germany with not only his whole organization but with his files intact. So a continuity of intelligence functions from the Third Reich to the United States to NATO to modern Germany. And again, all under this man, Reinhard Galen. Now, of some of the activities of Reinhard Galen's Foreign Armies East, and specifically the use of Turkic peoples in military units on the Eastern Front, we're going to encounter a name here who's a key person with regard to the World Anti-Communist League, and we're going to be coming back to him. Reading from Galen's Spy of the Century. From such Caucasian defectors was recruited a battalion, codenamed Bergman, or Miner, which grew to comprise three Georgian, one Azerbaijani, and one Armenian company under the command of Captain Theodor Oberlander. Some of these men went into action in October of 1942 at Terek and Mozduk, collecting 1,600 defectors from the Soviet division whose political commissar was Mikhail Suslov. So again, Theodor Oberlander, a key member of WACL, as we're going to look at shortly, was commanding a battalion composed of Turkic defectors fighting now against the USSR. Now, it's worth noting that the nation of Turkey essentially remained neutral, although they were quite sympathetic to the Axis. They remained neutral until the very end of the war when they came in on the side of the Allies. Now, the pan-Turkish activists were very, very bitter towards the Turkish government. Obviously, they wanted to bring the Turkish nation in on the side of the Axis as a means for assisting the German victory and for partitioning the Eurasian parts of the Soviet Union. Now, the Turkish government was a little more far-sighted than these individuals, and they basically held the rein in on the pan-Turkists because they were afraid that the pan-Turkists might eventually bring them into the war against the Soviet Union. Not that they were particularly enamored of the USSR, but they were afraid of it, and they felt that remaining neutral would be a better path for them to pursue in case, as it turned out to be, the USSR won the war, then they would not have a huge and powerful enemy on its borders. So because of this reason, because they didn't want to alienate the USSR, and as it turned out that was a far-sighted decision, the Turkish government reins in the pan-Turkists in Turkey because the pan-Turkists want to bring Turkey into the war on the side of the Axis. And in 1944, as the military fortunes were turning very obviously against the Germans and the pan-Turkists felt that their time was running out, a series of demonstrations broke out in Turkey to attempt to prevail the Turks to come in on the side of the Axis. They were put down, and a key name for our purposes crops up in connection with these demonstrations.
And we're going to be reading from Jacob Landau's book, Pan-Turkism in Turkey, and the name comes up at the very end, so there'll be a lot of other names before then. Reading from Landau's book, open conflict between pan-Turkists and the government was thus inevitable. Again, Dave just explained why there's conflict between the government and the pan-Turkists. The government wishing to remain neutral, the pan-Turkists not wishing to remain neutral. On February 20th and March 21st, 1944, respectively, Atsiz published two open letters to Premier Mehmet Sukru Sarkoglu in his monthly Orhun, denouncing subversive activities in Turkey, chiefly those of communists, and demanding more active Turkist, and by inference, pan-Turkist policy. Several issues of Orhun were confiscated, and the periodical was subsequently closed down. The pan-Turkists then took to the streets, crossing the critical threshold between ideological propaganda and political action. On May 3, 1944, in defiance of martial law regulations, large anti-communist demonstrations took place in both Istanbul and Ankara to protest against what the demonstrators considered the penetration of communism into Turkey's government bureaucracy and educational system. Pan-Turk slogans were also in evidence, probably inspired by growing anxiety over the fate of Turkic groups in the Soviet Union. The deportation of Tatars and others was then being planned and was in fact carried out a few days later. Such notable pan-Turkists as Atsiz, Turkan, and others were involved, as well as a young captain, Alparslan Turkesh, who was yet to make his mark in Turkish politics. Now, Alparslan Turkesh, along with a lot of other students and folks, were involved in Alparslan Turkesh is a man whose name we are going to hear a lot more of.
Okay, now Alparslan Turkesh is head of the National Action Party, which is, although it is pan-Turkist, it is also extremely fascist and racist in its outlook. The National Action Party is a dominant force in Turkey today, very closely allied with many NATO elements, and of course its youth wing, and it's explicitly fascist now, although it is pan-Turkist. This is this marriage of pan-Turkism and Nazism during the war here is what led to this outlook. Basically, the youth wing of the National Action Party are the Grey Wolves, of which Mehmet Ali Aja is probably the best-known member. Now, returning again to Theodor Oberliner, key member of WACL, and a fellow who was commanding a battalion composed of Turkic nationals who had been captured by the Germans and reformed into a unit fighting against the Soviet Union. Definitely, Theodor Oberliner had envisioned the use of the various ethnic nationalities of the Soviet Union as weapons against the Soviet Union and envisioned granting them equal ally status. This was something that most of the Germans did not want to do, and so it actually led to Oberlander's falling out of favor. But Oberlander had keyed the strategy, and this was used by Galen, of utilizing the various ethnic nationalities in the Soviet Union specifically as political allies and to be used in order to break up the USSR and defeat it militarily. I mention this because this is a key element of various aspects of the ABN today, the breakup of the Soviet Union, and the nationalist aspirations of the various ethnic nationalities were to be utilized by Oberlander. Reading from a book called Against Stalin and Hitler, written by a man named Wilfried Strickfeld, and that man is a key Galen aide, by the way. This book was copyright 1970, published in hardcover by the John Day Company. The important part here is he describes Oberlander and his philosophy. A proposal of Zeitzler, approved by Hitler, ran, quote, "Locally raised formations are not to be of more than battalion strength. Remuneration should be of some kind or other in money or promises." But at the very moment when Hitler ruled out units of more than one battalion strength, there had come into being the Cossack Division under General von Panwitz, the Russian Defense Corps in Serbia under the emigre General Stefan, and other large formations as well. Professor Oberlander was commanding the so-called Mountaineers Regiment, composed of Caucasians which had served with distinction in the Southern Army Group. This I learned from a memorandum of Oberlander's, a copy of which reached me from the OKW, that's German Military High Command. Oberlander pressed for the setting up of Russian and Ukrainian liberation armies with the status of allies. We've already seen Oberlander working with Turkic nationals and nationalities from the Soviet Union. Now we're going to take a look at Oberlander working with Ukrainians as well.
Okay, this is from a Village Voice article, May 14, 1985, headline Reagan and the War Crimes Lobby. The article is by Joe Connison. He also wrote the first article, along with Murray Wass, that we read tonight on the broadcast. A leading figure among the rightist emigres is, they're talking again about the rightist emigres who are specifically in this case trying to smash the Office of Special Investigations, which is investigating World War II war criminals in the United States, many of whom are Eastern European emigres, many of whom are strongly affiliated with the Reagan administration, as we've been talking about tonight. Among their supporters, not only Ronald Reagan, but his communications director, Pat Buchanan. A leading figure among the rightist emigres is Dr. Lev Dobryansky, Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas and chairman of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, the UCCA, and the Captive Nations Committee, Incorporated. Dobryansky, whose daughter Paula serves on the staff of the National Security Council, is also board chairman of a leading emigre publication, the Ukrainian Quarterly. Another is Yaroslav Stetsko, chairman of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, the ABN. We've been talking about them a lot tonight. And for a brief period in the summer of 1941, premier of the Independent Republic of the Ukraine. Stetsko, an elder statesman of the international far right, was received at the White House in July 1983 by the President and Vice President George Bush. He and Dobryansky also helped to create the World Anti-Communist League, the organizational haven for neo-Nazis, fascists, and anti-Semitic extremists from two dozen countries, formerly headed by racial theorist Roger Pearson. The spotty history of wartime Ukrainian nationalism is useful in understanding the anti-OSI campaign. OSI, of course, Office of Special Investigations, the people who are trying to deport these war criminals. It's useful in understanding the anti-OSI campaign in which Dobryansky, Stetsko, and their compatriots are implicated. For centuries, the believers in a separate Ukrainian state were frustrated by rulers from without, Polish, German, and Russian, and irritated by the presence on their soil of non-Ukrainians, principally Poles and Jews. These sentiments found expression in a variety of nationalist organizations, but the most important role during the war was played by the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, OUN, a fascistic outfit that freely employed terror and murder in its quest for a racially pure Ukrainian state. By 1940, after Hitler and Stalin divided the Ukraine between them, the OUN had split into two factions. The more active and radical, the OUNB, was identified by the last name of its would-be Führer, Stepan Bandera. His most trusted lieutenant was a young nationalist named Yaroslav Stetsko. Hitler's plan to invade the Soviet Union involved a campaign through the Ukraine, with the promised assistance of the OUN Bandera, whose chief patron in the Nazi regime was the real Führer's racial mentor, Alfred Rosenberg. But there was disagreement among the top Nazi leaders on the, quote, Ukrainian question. Heinrich Himmler and Martin Bormann, for example, insisted that Slavs were Untermenschen, lesser peoples whose only purpose on earth was to serve Aryan masters. To them, no Ukrainian state was tolerable. Rosenberg, himself a Baltic German, was more accommodating, and furthermore saw himself as the satrap of an eastern realm in a, quote, new Europe. OUN Bandera held its first and second congresses under Nazi auspices, and among its resolutions in 1941 was the following, quote, "The Jews in the Soviet Union are the most dependable underpinning of the ruling Bolshevist regime and an avant-garde of Muscovite imperialism in the Ukraine. The Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists opposes the Jews as a pillar of the Muscovite Bolshevist regime and at the same time is informing the mass of people that Moscow is the main enemy." Such was the ideological preparation for the Nazi invasion and the Holocaust that came in its wake. Simultaneously, the OUN Bandera was adopted by the Nazi spy apparatus, the Abwehr, to aid in the actual invasion both militarily and for intelligence purposes. Battalions of OUN Bandera volunteers under German command were formed both in occupied Poland, the Nachtigall or Nightingale Division, and in Austria, the Roland Division. Though the surviving adherents of the OUN Bandera deny it, historical evidence shows that the Ukrainian nationalists under Bandera reached for an agreement with the Nazis for the future control of the Ukraine. On June 30, 1941, the Nazi invasion reached Lvov, the capital of the Ukrainian province of Galicia, which was the OUN Bandera stronghold. That same evening, the OUN Bandera leaders who had traveled to Galicia with the Nazis declared a sovereign Ukrainian state, with Yaroslav Stetsko as, quote, premier. The division among the Nazis erupted in reaction to this declaration, and within 10 days, Stetsko was placed under honorary arrest by officers of the SS. Although this arrest is now portrayed as severe repression by the OUN Bandera, in fact, the Germans treated Bandera and his followers rather well, especially compared to the Jews and other victims of the final solution in Lvov, which was being carried out by Nazi Einsatzgruppen and Ukrainian, quote, militia, including many OUN Bandera men. Indeed, according to Alexander Dalin's authoritative German Rule in Russia, 1941-45, quote, "During the following days of chaos, after the entry into Lvov, it became obvious to the Germans that Bandera's followers, including those in the Nachtigall Regiment, were displaying considerable initiative, conducting purges and pogroms."
Okay, now, remember the Nachtigall Regiment, and in particular, note the use of the OUN Bandera and its formation in the SS, along with other elements of the various ethnic nationalities that had aspired to carve up the Soviet Union, including, as we looked at, the Pan-Turkists. Now, recall that in Radio Free America numbers 1 and 2, we took a look at the OUN Bandera, the warfare that they carried on in Eastern Europe under SS auspices. We looked at them at considerable length at the tail end of Radio Free America number 1, and again, looked at the OUN Bandera's role in the SS and how later they jumped to the CIA along with the Galen organization. Now, the head of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, the Einsatzgruppen were the mobile killing units that followed right behind the regular Wehrmacht units in Germany, and they simply dispatched the Jews, communists, and other people that the Nazis wanted to get rid of. Now, the Nachtigall Regiment composed largely of Ukrainian nationalists and fascists from the OUN Bandera. We'll tell you who was the head of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, referring to Theodor Oberländer and his wartime activities. At that time, Dr. Oberlander was an SS officer and a member of the notorious Abwehr. According to Die Zeit of Hamburg, he was an expert, quote, for the treatment of other races, unquote, and the political officer of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall. Okay, so Oberlander is commander of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall involving fascist Ukrainians. Oberlander's unit entered Lemberg on June 30th and remained in the city 6 days. According to Reitlinger and other sources, 7,000 people were killed, chiefly between July 2nd and 4th. Oberlander does not deny that he was in Lemberg these days, but says that during his stay, not a single shot was fired. And now after the close of World War II, let me tell you what I was reading from there. I was reading from a book called The New Germany and the Old Nazis, authored by a man named T.H. Tettens, a German anti-fascist, and it was published in hardcover by Random House Copyright in 1961. That's the section of the book I was just reading from. Let me read you some more, again, from The New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Tettens. After World War II, Dr. Theodor Oberlander went on to become a key cabinet minister under Dr. Adenauer's government. Recall in Radio Free America number 2, we looked at Adenauer's role as a Nazi functionary as the wartime mayor of Cologne. Now, Dr. Theodor Oberlander, SS man, commander of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, composed of Ukrainians, the man who worked with the ethnic Turks, goes on to become the cabinet minister for XPLA. Now, in Radio Free America number 2, we looked at how the XPLA office and that ministry in the West German government had basically become a vehicle for the agitation for Nazi expansion and the restoration of the 1937 borders of the Reich. And the XPLA group espoused an expanded Reich, which would involve such cities as Warsaw and Prague, a greatly expanded Germany. Theodor Oberlander becomes the head of this particular ministry. We also looked at this ministry in connection with Radio Free America number 11, and we're going to come back to it in Radio Free America number 15, because this group was very much involved with some of the people involved with the assassination of President Kennedy. Dr. Walter Becker is one of the main names, Gerhard Frey another. We looked at that in Radio Free America number 11, the XPLA ministry and its role in the Kennedy assassination. We're going to come back to that in our next program. But again, Oberlander was head of that group, reading from The New Germany and the Old Nazis. Of all his cabinet ministers, the minister for XPLA, Dr. Theodor Oberlander, caused the chancellor most chagrin. As a high Nazi official and officer of the SS, he was Reichsfuhrer of the German alliance in the East, Dr. Oberlander had used the Nazi press to demand the expulsion and extermination of the Slavic peoples and the rapid colonization of the vast conquered territories by the German master race. For years, German Democratic papers had charged Dr. Oberlander with packing the ranks of his ministry with former Nazis. Skipping down, the Ministry for XPLA, once headed by Oberlander, is still known as a haven for former high-ranking Nazis. The personal assistant to the minister is today Dr. Wolfram, a former SS officer. The fanatical race propagandist Werner Wensky, ex-mayor of Lodz, serves as director of a department. Head of the press office, Dr. Schlichter, was a stormtroop leader. So again, Oberlander, head of the XPLA office, that office a key vehicle for Nazi, for not only a refuge for Nazi war criminals, a vehicle for Nazi agitation, connected with the German elements who were coordinating with American fascist elements in the Kennedy assassination. Again, check that with Radio Free America number 11, Radio Free America 2, with more information about the XPLA office, and we're coming back to it in our next show.
Okay, reading from a manuscript by Peter Dale Scott, from the English Department of the University of California at Berkeley. Peter Dale Scott, as Dave, I believe, mentioned earlier in the show, a well-known researcher in the field, man who has authored many, many well-known articles on such subjects as the Kennedy assassination and other things, has also done a lot of work on the subject matter that we're talking about tonight, namely the World Anti-Communist League, which, of course, winds up to be intimately connected to the Kennedy assassination.
By the way, the name of this manuscript, it's called Government Documents and the JFK Assassination, like the Dallas Conspiracy, available from Tom Davis Books.
Okay, reading from Peter Dale Scott's manuscript. Nelson Bunker Hunt, meanwhile, and of course those of you who know this is Hunt of the famous H.L. Hunt family.
Also Hunt of the Wackle Group, and who we've looked at so often.
Nelson Bunker Hunt, meanwhile, had become the Texas representative of a German-based intelligence network, the ICDCC, or International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, which paradoxically united many of the CIA's most prominent opponents within the United States. Most notably, China lobbyist General Charles Willoughby, General MacArthur's former G2 in Japan and Korea, with representatives from CIA-sponsored organizations abroad, such as the Ukrainians cultivated by the Galen Organization, parenthetically the folks we've just been talking about. One chairman of the ICDCC, Hermann Punder, was a former Abwehr agent and close ally of Galen's sponsors, Konrad Adenauer and Hermann Abs of the Deutsche Bank. Konrad Adenauer, of course, became the Chancellor of Germany after World War II. Hermann Abs of the Deutsche Bank, one of the most important financial wheels in Germany before, during, and after World War II. While a later chairman, Theodor Oberlander, was close to the right-wing German emigre group to whose newspaper, General Walker, spoke by long-distance telephone on November 22, 1963, transmitting the story, accepted by the Warren Report, that Oswald, that's of course Lee Harvey Oswald, had shot at Walker in April of 1963. The ICDCC also appears to have been particularly concerned about the future of Vietnam. Thus, Oberlander represented the ICDCC at the 1966 conference of the Asian People's Anti-Communist League. Again, the APACL we talked about earlier. A pro-GM group, along with several of GM's original backers in the United States, notably Father Raymond DeJager of the Free Pacific Association, and such other luminaries as Tom Charles Houston, then the Secretary General of Marvin Liebman's World Youth Crusade for Freedom, and later, after a two-year stint in Army Intelligence, the author of the White House Houston Plan. And by the way, the Houston Plan, authored in the Nixon White House, was so absolutely repressive and so absolutely flouting of conventional constitutional rights that Nixon had to tear it up, although, of course, the actual things that were written into the plan went on anyway, and some of them wound up being Watergate.
Okay, now, note in that passage that Theodor Oberlander, the Adenauer Minister for Expellees, is involved with this ICDCC with two of the key names we looked at before in Aryan Nations, Charles Willoughby, the German-born MacArthur intelligence chief, and also Bunker Hunt, Key Bircher, member of the Hunt family, and participant in the JFK assassination, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 11. These guys combining with Theodor Oberlander in the ICDCC. Just to show you how some of these elements are continuous to the present day, the following article comes from the Arizona Republic, research credit to Ted Rubenstein. This is from the Arizona Republic of January 30th, 1983. It's a story headlined, CIA Allegedly Has Data on Pope Attacker. This is by Robert D. Kaplan of the Cox News Service, Dateline Ankara. This country's most respected authority on terrorism said in an interview that the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency had its own agent, an ethnic Turk born in the Soviet Union, working immediately with right-wing Turkish militants close to gunman Mehmet Ali Aja, who was convicted in the 1981 shooting of Pope John Paul II. Ugur Mumcu, an author, journalist, and former law professor, said Ruzi Nazar, R-U-Z-I-N-A-Z-A-R, a Turk who defected from the Soviet Army in World War II and was recruited by the CIA after the war, was successful in penetrating Turkish fascist circles in the days when Aja worked as a hired gun for the National Movement Party, a leading right-wing organization. Mumcu said that Nazar, a man now about 60, was born near Tashkent in Soviet Turkestan and is believed to be living in Bonn, West Germany with his West German wife. According to Mumcu, Nazar is retired from active service with the CIA. Although the CIA and the U.S. government are saying nothing for many obvious reasons, the CIA absolutely has to know things about Aja of its own accord, which nobody else knows, Mumcu said. Concerning Nazar's ties with Turkish right-wing circles, Mumcu said, quote, in a letter to MHP, National Movement Party leader Alparslan Türkeş, that's the fellow we looked at in the 1944 pro-German demonstrations, a letter that I have seen, a friend of Nazar, Enver Altalay, wrote about Nazar's influence in right-wing Turkish student groups in West Germany. Mumcu said Nazar's CIA links have been verified by a Turkish general who maintained close contact with Nazar. Nazar was in close contact with the MHP leader at the same time that Aja and Musa Serdar Celebi were, Mumcu said. So, according to the top Turkish expert on terrorism, an ethnic Turk born in the Soviet Union, captured by the Germans, who then fought against the Soviet Union during World War II as one of these Turks who fought with the Wehrmacht, then jumps to CIA after the war, is apparently very close to Alparslan Türkeş, head of the fascist National Action Party, and again, a man, as we saw, who was arrested in 1944 while attempting to persuade Turkey to come into the war on the side of Germany. And to show you just what Ruzi Nazar is doing today, Nip Tuck is going to read you a short section from a new Village Voice.
Just this short section? This one here? Okay,
unless you want to read the rest of it there.
Well, I think time-wise, we can probably get back to that other stuff later, and we've talked about a lot of it. Let me just read you a very short segment from this Village Voice article for the newspaper newspaper week of December 31st, 1985. We've mentioned this article before. It's an excellent article on some of the latest developments on the assassination of the Pope and the beginnings of the crumbling of the Bulgarian story and the revealing of the stuff that we've been talking about all along, which is the involvement of numerous right-wing groups in this attempt on the life of the Pope back in 1981. Anyway, just a short segment to let you know one of the things that Ruzi Nazar, who Dave was just reading you about, is up to these days. Friend and colleague of many of Mehmet Ali Agah, the would-be assassin's friends and colleagues. Again, reading from the Village Voice article by Martin Lee and Kevin Coogan. From the December 31st, 1985 issue, again, speaking of Ruzi Nazar, the gentleman that Dave was reading about, Ruzi Nazar, a friend of National Action Party Chief Colonel Arpaslan Terkesh, continues to play a leading role in the ABN. This September, Nazar represented the ABN at the World Anti-Communist League Convention in Dallas.